Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning here in New York. I was so glad to hear that rain last night. We needed it so badly. It was just beautiful downpour, and now we woke up to a beautiful morning here, and I know my garden's been watered, and all my plants and trees have been watered, and so that saves me lots of time and makes my plants all happy, so all's good. Anyway, I wanted to welcome you all to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a great show planned for you today. My guest will be Danielle Nirenberg. She is the co-founder and president of Food Tank, a great organization that I'm going to tell you more about in a little bit and let her tell us a lot more about it. But first, I want to share with you some of the things going on in and around New York, things that I hope you all can get involved in, starting with this June 30th. We have a rally taking place in New York City at the Grand Hyatt, and that is on Monday evening from 5:30 to 7. There's going to be a big fundraiser that Governor Cuomo will be at, and we want to be there banning or letting him know that we want there to be a ban on fracking here in New York State, along with a rally to stop the Port Ambrose that they want to build out into the Long Island Sound. And that would be a port for liquefied natural gas, and it's right where we're hoping in the future we have a wind farm. So let's all band together, show Governor Cuomo that we want to support natural renewable resources, and we do not want fracking to go any further into this state. So again, that is on Monday, June 30th, at the Grand Hyatt, which is 109 East 42nd Street, from 5:30 to 7. You'll be joining Food and Water Watch, New York is Against Fracking, IE Green, Sierra Club, and all the other environmental action groups that are, you know, banding together to really hold our ground against fracking and stand up to the big corporations that are trying to move it forward. The following weekend on July 6th, Restoration Farm continues with their Tin House Music Concert Series, and they are doing that throughout the season on the first Sunday of every month from 2 to 5. They have music lined up from 3 to 5, and from 2 to 3, it's an open mic. So if you are a budding singer, someone who loves to perform, come on down and you'll have your chance at the mic as well. Restoration Farm is a wonderful organic farm right on the grounds of Old Bethpage Village in Old Bethpage, and they have a CSA as well as a farmer's market on the weekends right in the parking lot. So come down, learn about Restoration Farm and join in the music. July 9th, 23rd, August 6th, and August 20th, I am hosting a farm-to-table cooking classes right here in Old Westbury. You can sign up from my website. And these cooking classes will be harvesting some vegetables that are ready to be harvested from the garden, and I'll supplement what I can't get from the garden, and we'll be doing cooking classes. The first one is more of an Asian theme. The second one is more of a Mediterranean theme. I haven't yet gotten to the third and fourth menus yet, but you can sign up, like I said, on my website, and I'd love to see some of you there. July 24th is a farm-to-table dinner for socially responsible investing. 350.org, you know, a couple years ago when they were doing their Do the Math tour, they were raising awareness about divesting in all fossil fuel companies. And for those of us that, you know, invest money yet have no idea what we're investing in, this is a way to take some responsibility and invest in only the type of companies that you ethically feel connected to. So, or at least the ones that morally you are opposed to keep your money out of those companies. So come down and learn some more about that. The dinner is free for those interested in social responsible investing. Also on July 27th, Slow Food North Shore is going to be having our first summer event celebrating our new Snail of Approval restaurant called the Purple Elephant. And that's going to be July 27th from 6 to 9 at the Purple Elephant, which is in Northport. We have a great menu planned. We're creating an Eventbrite, so by tomorrow you should be able to purchase tickets to that. Okay, so that's what's going on in the city. Some things that I'd love you all to sign petitions on, which you can find on my website. The first one is to oppose the new 2,4-D resistant genetically modified crop that the Environmental Protection Agency right now is considering passing. It's Dow Chemical Company, and they have applied to add this new pesticide to the already Roundup Ready GE seeds, and it was just adding bad onto bad. And you know, especially with the new research that's being done linking autism to pesticide use, and we already know so many other problems, not only environmental but health-wise, are being linked to pesticides. So we just want to go in the opposite direction. We don't want to add more chemicals to our food. So please sign that petition and let the EPA know that you do not want them to approve Dow's new chemical 2,4-D. That's the part that was in Agent Orange. So we want to keep that out of our food. You also want to tell New York State lawmakers to pass the Shared Clean Energy Bill, and this is going to bring solar energy more into mainstream and allow people that might not be homeowners but might only be renters to also be able to participate in clean energy and solar energy. So that petition is also on my website. And I also wanted to just let you all know that Greenpeace has now come out with their own scorecard in sustainable seafood. And you can find out more about that also on my website. And I'm sure many of you heard about the passing of the environmental law for greenhouse gas emissions. You know, it was a victory for the EPA, although not a complete victory. It was very confusing reading through the article on this bill being passed. But the bottom line is it was a win for the environmentalists. They are going to be able to limit greenhouse gas emissions and put a carbon tax on that, and that's a good thing. So I was really happy to see that. So now I want to share with you a recipe. I've actually been playing with Jerusalem artichoke syrup, and that's another new, I don't know how new it is, but new to me, sweetener, similar to brown rice syrup or even maple syrup. And it's, you know, higher on the glucose index. And I made gluten-free pumpkin muffins using this Jerusalem artichoke syrup, and they came out great. So I wanted to share that all with you. You're going to start with 4 eggs that you're going to whisk together, 2/3 cup of water, 1 can of organic pumpkin, 1.5 cups of Jerusalem artichoke syrup, 1.5 cups of Pamela gluten-free bread flour, 2 cups of Pamela gluten-free cake flour, 1 cup of oil, 1 teaspoon baking powder, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 teaspoons baking soda, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, 1 teaspoon nutmeg, 1 teaspoon allspice, and 1/2 a cup of shredded coconut. And you're going to combine the eggs, the water, the pumpkin, and oil in a large bowl. And in another bowl, combine all the dry ingredients. Then you add the dry ingredients to the wet ingredients, mix them together until they're combined, and then you're going to prepare muffin tins with some cupcake liners, fill them about 2/3 full, and you're going to bake them at a 350 oven for about 20 minutes or until a toothpick comes out clean. And as far as the frosting, if you want to frost them, You can make a cream cheese frosting. It's similar to a carrot cake. You can make cream cheese frosting. You can make a tofu frosting, or you can just dust them with some organic powdered sugar, and that's really lovely as well. Okay, so it's now my pleasure to introduce my guest today, Danielle Nirenberg. As I said, she is the president and co-founder of Food Tank, and she's an expert on sustainable agriculture and food issues. She's written extensively on gender and population and the spread of factory farming on developing world, and has also written about new innovations in sustainable agriculture. Danielle co-founded Food Tank in 2013 as an organization focused on building a global community for safe, healthy, and nourished eaters. And prior to that, Danielle spent 2 years traveling to more than 35 countries through Africa, Asia, and Latin America, meeting farmers and farmers groups, along with scientists, policymakers, government leaders, and then helped to write about that in her work with World Watch Institute. Danielle, are you with me?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
Sure. So last time I had you on, you were just in the process of getting ready to launch Food Tank. And now that you have launched it, I'd love you to tell us how it's going and the mission of Food Tank so that everybody out there listening knows what we're talking about.
Sure. Our mission is really to highlight stories of hope and success in the food system and to cultivate, you know, individual eaters, other organizations, original research, and events to really push for food system change. And so the last year has been very exciting. Food Tank grew very quickly. We now have a community of 111,000 people who receive our weekly newsletter. We've built some amazing partnerships with a number of different groups, including the Barilla Center for Food and Nutrition, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, other NGOs, and community groups all over the world. So it's been a really, really exciting year, and I think we're off to a good start.
Great. Can you share what some of the issues that Food Tank's working on right now?
Absolutely. You know, the one that's been really exciting for us is the International Year of Family Farming. 2014 is the International Year of Family Farming. It was designated by the United Nations. And we've been partnering, again, with United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and other groups to highlight all the things that family farmers do in addition to food production. Farmers aren't just farmers. They're businesswomen, they're innovators and entrepreneurs, they're teachers who share their innovations in their communities, and they're stewards of natural resources who are rarely recognized for the important ecosystem services they provide that really benefit everyone. So it's been great to tell their stories on our website and our newsletter. We produced our first research report in March of this year, highlighting the role of family farming in food production and environmental sustainability. And so that's, you know, we'll continue to do that throughout the year, to continue to put a face to family farmers and really let people know why they're so important.
Mm-hmm. And are you focused on family farmers more in this country or worldwide?
Worldwide, domestically and internationally, and both small and large, and really highlighting the different roles that they play. Not all big farmers are bad farmers, and you know, breaking down some of the myths around agriculture has been an important role for us to play.
Mm-hmm. I know a few weeks ago, the New York Times had reported that 1 in 3 families in this country are involved in growing food in some way, and I remember reading that and just feeling really surprised because I know lots of people, and many of them, I'd say most of them, are not growing their own food. What do you think about that article? Do you think that's a trend in this country, that there really are 1 in 3 families, and do you see that growing?
You know, I don't know where they got their statistics from, but I'm actually not surprised. I think most people are sort of craving a connection to the food system and growing their own, whether it's, you know, a few basil plants on their windowsill or having a garden in their backyard. You know, those are all ways for people to really connect and you know, feel good about what they're doing and have some sort of pride over the food that they're eating. So I'm really not surprised, and I do think it's a growing trend. It's one that's growing all over the world. For some people, it's out of necessity. If you look at how food prices have risen and never really gone down since 2007 and 2008 in developing countries, you know, people have been really forced in urban settings to grow their own food because they can't afford to buy all of their own food from the market. So in places like the United States, since, you know, for the last decade, people have been really, you know, going to farmers markets more. We have more than 8,000 farmers markets in this country now. That's really risen dramatically since the early 2000s. You have people who are really, again, craving that connection, trying to improve their diets or realizing that local or homegrown food often tastes better than what they've been getting at the grocery store. So I think it's a trend that will continue because people want to have that closer connection to where their food comes from.
Mm-hmm. And that would be the same for urban farming, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, urban dwellers, as much as, you know, folks who live in rural communities or the suburbs, you know, want that closer connection. And, you know, they're because, you know, folks are going to farm to table restaurants and they're seeing, you know, gardens on rooftops, especially in places like New York City, it doesn't seem that foreign to them now to want to grow their own food. And again, whether it's, you know, a few herbs on the windowsill or having a community garden plot, people want that connection and they know the food tastes better. And I think for a lot of folks, that's what it comes down to. Like, oh gosh, this really tastes a lot better than what I've normally been eating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've been reading, I know there was an article this week in the Times about, you know, the move to try to bring some of the healthier food into the schools, but that the kids are just throwing the healthy food out. Do you think that is, I mean, I know what my feeling is on that. My feeling is because they're not making it taste good. Do you think that there's a future for healthy food in the school lunches, and is there a way that we can make the food taste better so that the kids are going to eat it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it doesn't do any good to grow, you know, sustainably grown food if no one's going to eat it. And I think you're right, you know, some of these, although school cafeterias have come a long way over the last decade, I think where we haven't sort of made the leap is in culinary skills and making healthy food taste good, you know, on a large scale for kids. You know,
yeah,
bon
it makes me crazy to see, you know, hear people say that, you know, a kid just throws their broccoli right out because it doesn't taste good, when I know you can make broccoli taste so good, and it has, you know, it has to be a bright green color. It can't be overcooked in olive green, mushy. You know, I mean, there's ways to cook it and ways not to cook it, and it's very frustrating when you hear about kids not liking healthy food, because I know that it can taste good, and I just feel like they're not making it taste good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, if you overcook food, whether it's sustainably grown or conventionally grown, it's still not going to taste good. So, you know,
right,
really finding ways to work with, you know, cooks and cafeteria workers to relearn some of the cooking skills. I mean, you have to remember that a lot of these schools didn't have, you know, cook stoves and stovetops. They were mostly microwaving meals. And so relearning, you know, the culinary skills that are needed to make food taste delicious for kids is, you know, we haven't taken the extra step yet.
Right,
and
right.
So,
and we don't have the money.
Right. And, you know, so I think that, you know, we've come a long way, but there's really still a long way to go in school lunches. You know, I think it's been great that there are more school gardens, you know, across the country, and kids are knowing where their food comes from. But I think again, we need some extra steps. Kids need to be involved in food preparation. They need to know what a portion size looks like, you know, like a normal portion size. They need to know, have regular cooking skills. They need to know how to have a meal with someone. You know, kids eat in cars and, you know, on the go all the time, and sharing a meal and relearning conviviality and sharing food are skills that we're losing. And, you know, we need to teach those things, not just to kids, but to adults again. And I think, you know, so, you know, again, it's not just enough to have school gardens, and it's not just enough to have local food in schools. You need to, we need to build that extra step in.
You're so right. I mean, you know, as one of over 200 slow food chapter leaders here in New York, or no, I'm sorry, here in the country, you know, that's what slow food's about, is, you know, building the conviviality and eating a shared meal and the pleasures of the table. And you're so right. Needing to sit down with people at a table. And, you know, I actually had a teacher on a couple of months ago. He was talking about not just your food manners, but what children pick up on just natural conversation that happens around the table. Without that, you're missing out on certain skills. I mean, conversations that happen around the table and just negotiating rides and compromises and who's picking who up and all those other subtle skills that you don't even realize you're learning when you're sitting around a table taking part of conversation your whole life as a child. You know, they're missing out on that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's you know, what I was trying to get at earlier, we need to take that extra step. We need to talk about conviviality, and it's not just about eating. It's about sharing, and that, you know, the discussion that you mentioned happens when you're sharing food and talking about food, and, you know, it leads to other things. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate with people's busy lives, and, you know, when so many people are just working two or three jobs just to make a living, you know, I think it's hard for folks to take the time to do that, obviously. But
right.
Building in, you know, a day a week or you know, even if you don't have kids or, you know, you live by yourself, sharing meals with coworkers or your neighbors, you know, we've lost sort of that sense of sharing
community.
Meals. Yeah, and sharing meals, you know, that's it's such a basic, people have always shared food and always, you know,
right.
gotten together over food, and we've lost that, and I think we're losing much more because of it.
I would actually like to ask, since you've done so much traveling and see the food trends, not just in this country, but around the world, is that a trend that you see in other parts of the world too, or is that really kind of a U.S.
Yeah, I mean, Ian, it's something that you see in places as diverse as Italy, which we think is sort of the food center of the world. You know, people there are eating more meals on the go. You see it in places like sub-Saharan Africa because people are moving to cities and, you know, just really struggling to make ends meet. They're not sharing food as much as they did or sharing meals together. So it's really a worldwide trend. And, you know, again, it's something's lost when you're not able to share meals with your friends or neighbors or family.
Yes, I agree. I know when you set out to and started Food Tank, one of your goals was to be able to engage our young people in the food movement. How's that going? Have you been successful in getting them involved? And can you share with us how?
Yeah, one of the partnerships that we have had is with the Barilla Center for Food and Nutrition, and they have a Young Earth Solutions contest every year that brings together young researchers under 30. And these are folks, you know, who are not necessarily scientists, but students and young people who have ideas for making a better food system. And so it's been really exciting, you know, last year especially, we were talking to kids at different universities and colleges and really engaging them and getting them excited about this contest. And Food Tank was one of the judges, and it was just really exciting to see the solutions that these kids came up with and their interest in making the food system better. You know, some of the other things that we're planning to do, Next year, we'll have our first food tank summit in Washington, D.C., and we'll have a it'll be a very dynamic event with, we hope to have youth representatives on every panel so that, you know, they're not just sitting in the audience taking information from experts, but being considered experts, because I think it's, you know, so important that their voices are heard and out there, because they're the ones who are developing the solutions. My generation and previous generations have done a lot to really mess up the food system. So I think it's important that, you know, we look at the next generation as experts and leaders, you know, not just as farmers, but as food scientists, as activists, storytellers, as people who can really make the change happen, because they have all of these great new ideas. They're interested in technology and using information and communication technology in different ways to support a better food system. So I'm really excited about the opportunity that exists there, because hearing their voices is going to be so important.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know some people have been involved in like food hackathons. Have you heard about those?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's just such a great way to, you know, combine interest in technology and interest in food and really get people thinking creatively in different ways.
Yeah, yeah, that's how I feel, too. I think it's really great. You know, we were just talking about school lunches and, you know, the kids throwing their food out. And we, you know, those of us in the food movement are very aware of food waste as being such a big problem here on the planet. How is Food Tank addressing that, and how are you, you know, trying to get that message out to people?
Yeah, food waste has been a huge focus area for us. You know, 1.3 billion tons of food is wasted each year. About 30% of all food that's produced in developing countries goes to waste. It's around 40% in the industrialized world. You know, and food waste happens on so many different levels. You know, some of it happens in the field, some of it happens during transport, some of it happens during storage, and then a lot of it happens on the retail and consumer end. So last year in New York City, we had an event called Food Waste Free NYC, and we sold out an off-Broadway theater to have this event that brought together experts from all over the world to talk about the challenges they face in addressing food waste and also the solutions that are out there. So everyone from representatives of the United Nations Environment Program to food activists like Grow NYC in New York City to experts from the United Kingdom and all over the world to really talk about what they're finding. And, you know, it's startling to me that more isn't being done around food waste, because it's really the low-hanging fruit in the food system. The solutions that are out there are very easy. They're often very inexpensive. And one thing that's going on right now is the United States Department of Agriculture is calling upon businesses, and especially restaurants and food retailers, to take the U.S. Food Waste Challenge. And what it means is to really figure out ways in their business to prevent food waste. And so everything from, you know, not serving big portion sizes at their restaurants and having food go to waste, to reassessing use-by and sell-by dates in retail stores so the consumers don't throw away food before it's actually gone bad. And then there are other things that can be done. You know, I think, and this goes back to what I said before about the loss of culinary skills, you know, as cooks, we trust the dates on the label rather than our own senses. You know, food, the dates on the expiration dates and the use-by and sell-by dates are very arbitrary. They're not federally regulated. So most of them don't mean a lot. They're very confusing for consumers. They're confusing for retailers, to be quite honest. So, you know, if you look at something, and no matter what the date says, you know, use your own common sense. You know, smell it, touch it. Does it look slimy? Does it smell bad? Then it's probably not good to eat. But if it still looks good, it still smells good, it's probably fine. So really learning to trust ourselves again as consumers, I think, is an important way to prevent food waste in the home. And then, you know, a lot of things are done. Oh, say that, you know, you let that bag of tomatoes that you got at the farmer's market get too mushy, or you know, that the bag of broccoli got pushed to the back of the refrigerator and you know, it went bad before you could eat it. There are lots of ways, and New York City has been doing this, you know, implementing a composting program so that consumers can, you know, have an outlet for their food waste so that it just doesn't go into the landfills and rot. It can become an important, it goes from being, you know, considered quote unquote waste to being an important resource as fertilizer after it's made into compost. So all of these things are really letting, you know, consumers and retailers and policymakers know what they can do and really raising the awareness that's needed to prevent this massive amount of food waste that doesn't need to happen.
Right. That was an article in the New York Times. They were talking about, there was a two-part to the article, one talking about the healthy school lunch program, and then the downside was how all the kids aren't eating it, but the good side was that they were now starting to implement compost programs in the schools so that that unopened banana can go right into a landfill. And
it should really be the last resort, though. You know, food should be eaten, and you know, the whole bananas and uneaten food, it's
crazy,
not what you
right?
want going in the composting bin. You want food scraps to go in there, the peels of things, or, you know, the waste off plates after a meal. But, you know, you don't want just food uneaten.
I know.
There
I was reading that article. I'm going, why don't they just take the banana back? And I've worked in school kitchens, and I know the rule. If it's been on the tray, they say they're not allowed to, which is a stupid rule. And we have to change that rule because they were throwing, you know, kids were throwing milks out. Like, in order to get a free and reduced lunch, they have to give a complete meal, which means they have to give the milk, even if the kid's not going to drink the milk. So they give all these milks, and the unopened milks are going directly into the garbage, rather than collecting them and, you know, they say they're not allowed to resell them. And, if, you know, I understand that, but then give them away, you know. It's really
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah. The rules that they set up just sometimes just, I don't know, they make me crazy. Anyway, Danielle, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, farming and the future of farming and, you know, what we can do to get more people involved in that. Okay?
Great.
Everyone listening, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Danielle Nuremberg from Food Tank. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Danielle Nuremberg from Food Tank, and we're talking about the future of food on the planet. So, Danielle, are you with me?
Absolutely.
Great. So, you know, I'd say so many of our farmers now are, you know, the age of 60 and over, and you know, that's definitely a problem for the future of farming in this country. What can we do to get more young people involved in growing food and taking on farming and making it affordable for them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the latest agricultural census from USDA puts the average age of farmers in the United States at 58.3 years old, and it's similar to the age of farmers in the European Union and also in sub-Saharan Africa, where the average age of farmers is around 60 years old. So we really need to do something to cultivate that next generation of farmers and agricultural leaders. Unfortunately, you know, and this is a problem that's really true all over the world, young and new farmers often face, you know, a number of barriers. And maybe the biggest one is the lack of access to affordable land. And, you know, it's very hard for new or young farmers to have access to land if they didn't grow up in farming. And, you know, there are a number of programs now from, you know, the National Farmers Union and other young farmers and new farmers groups that are really trying to build mentorship programs into place where old farmers and younger farmers can connect with one another, you know, build leasing opportunities for land so that the young farmers have land available and that they can learn and receive mentorship from these older generations of farmers. But we, you know, in the developing world, you know, one of the reasons that youth migrate is they don't see farming as an opportunity. And, you know, farming needs to be both sort of intellectually stimulating as well as economically sustainable. And so rural infrastructure is really needed. Again, this is something that's true both in the United States and elsewhere in the world. You need better broadband and internet services in places. You need ways to make rural communities more lively and more interesting so that people want to stay there. And farming really needs to be seen as something that's profitable. And these are all changes that need to happen. I think, you know, the sort of one, or maybe there were a couple, but one of the bright spots, one of the few bright spots out of the most recent farm bill is that there was more money allocated to fruit and vegetable farmers in the United States instead of the big commodity farmers. And that will hopefully, you know, free up some money to encourage young and new fruit and vegetable growers to really be able to go into farming and take it on. But we really have to do something to make sure that the next generation can take over because, you know, farming, you know, it can't be an old man's job. It has to be something that young people want to be involved in as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially such hard work. I mean, if, you know, I have, since I've been doing gardening, which is, I can't call it farming because it's so much smaller than someone does farming, but to me it feels like farming. I mean, it is hard, manual labor, and it's certainly more fun when you do it with other people, but it's physically exhausting. I guess, you know, if you're doing it with machinery, it's a little bit less. If you're doing it on your hands and knees the way the majority of the world is doing it, it is, you know, heavy physical labor. And, you know, it's a lot for somebody who's getting older.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, there's, you know, not all technology is bad. And so combining high and low technologies that can make things like pumping water easier for, you know, women farmers or finding new tools that make farming less backbreaking and really give, you know, farmers access to these things and create, you know, the opportunity for them so they don't see farming just as drudgery, that they see it something as, you know, where they're using both their minds and their bodies to grow food. And I think, you know, that's something we often ignore. We don't think of farmers as smart, and really they're the smartest people in the world. They have to do all of these multiple roles, and we don't recognize them for that, and we don't recognize them for their traditional knowledge. And I think that's something where we've really failed, is, you know, going into communities in the developing world especially and telling farmers what they need rather than asking them what they want and learning from them. And, you know, it's not just the industrialized world and agricultural development agencies that have a lot to teach. We also have a lot to learn from the farmers who have been doing this work for generations and who know the land intimately, who know their crops very intimately, who have that knowledge that's just, you know, been passed down from generation to generation. Recognizing that knowledge is more important than ever before because of the impacts of climate change. You know, I think the drought that we saw in the United States in the Midwest in 2012 and the drought that's been going on in California, farmers are realizing that, gosh, we have to learn different ways of growing things. And, you know, they also have a lot to learn from farmers in other parts of the world who've been dealing with climate change for a long time and realizing that they've had to, you know, go back to some of their traditional and indigenous crops. These are crops that tend to be more hardy. They're resistant to drought. They're resistant to pest and disease. And so, you know, recognizing that that traditional knowledge holds a lot of power is going to be crucial for the future of farming.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, another issue that's really been in the news a lot, and I know you guys just sent out a great newsletter about soil degradation and the problem in our soil and how it's being so depleted from one you know, generation to the next. What kind of initiatives or programs is Food Tank trying to help spread to help with the soil issue?
Well, you know, what we pointed out in our post was that, you know, soil is the most often the most underappreciated and overlooked ingredient. And it's really the basis of all food production. And unfortunately, industrial agricultural practices, you know, that are very dependent on monoculture crops and the heavy use of inputs, artificial fertilizers and agrochemicals can really deplete soils. And we really need to build them back up. And I think one of the most interesting projects that's going on is the Land Institute in Kansas and a researcher named Jerry Glover from USAID have been really looking into the use of perennial crops to build soils and you know, have multiple benefits, including being resistant to climate change. Perennial grains have a lot of potential for other perennial crops. They have deeper root systems. They can go deeper down for water. They keep soils in place. They nourish soils. Other projects, you know, including agroforestry projects that are taking place all over sub-Saharan Africa, growing trees along with crops can, again, keep soil in place, provide nutrients, and in a lot of cases, if you're using leguminous trees, provide a natural source of fertilizer to crops so that you don't need to buy expensive fertilizer out of a bag. It occurs naturally. Trees do other things that help soils, you know, by keeping water and moisture in the ground. They help crops because they can provide shading. So they're, you know, often, you know, when you're talking about sustainable agriculture, it's not just one sort of benefit that you're getting from an intervention or an innovation. You're getting multiple benefits, and that's,
right,
you know, what you want from a farming system.
Absolutely. Actually, I had Wes Jackson on my show last week from the Land Institute, and that's what we were talking about, the perennial crops and the need to bring back the awareness of the interconnectedness of all these different elements so that you can't just focus on one part, but you really have to see how they all are related and how they work together. So do you feel like it will be possible to feed the planet in a sustainable way? I mean, do you see the future of agriculture being able to go that way?
Yeah, I just don't think we have a choice. I think, you know, human ingenuity will figure out a way to do this. And we have so many models of sustainable practices that are already working, but the problem is we haven't invested in them. And so I feel very hopeful about the future of food. Unfortunately, I think, you know, we've waited a long time to realize that business as usual in farming isn't going to help the planet. You know, in a climate-constrained world, we really need to find different ways to grow food. We need to find different ways to eat food. We need to think very differently about our diets. And I think, you know, we're sort of at this tipping point now. And I think, you know, policymakers and businesses and individual eaters are really realizing that change needs to happen now before it's too late. And so that's, I think that's a lot of what we're seeing in people wanting to grow more of their own food, being more interested in food and knowing where it comes from. So I have a lot of hope. I think the solutions are out there. We know what they are. We just need to invest in them more.
Right. And trying to get Congress to invest in them. You know, we're up against all the money that is paid off to them by these big corporations, and they seem to still be holding the power. So it's really so refreshing to hear your optimism and your belief and hope that we can, you know, all stand together. I mean, I think that's what Food Tank is really doing, is bringing so many of the big players together to create a bigger bigger coalition to work towards sustainable agriculture in a really big, more global way. And I really love the work you're doing, so thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
You know, one thing I wanted to touch on is hunger. you know, and how Food Tank is addressing that. I mean, we have, you know, obesity in one sense, you know, where, you know, people think if people are obese, you know, they're not also malnourished. But right now we're seeing obesity and malnourishment together. You want to explain to people how that's possible?
Yeah,
and what we can
absolutely.
Do about this?
We have roughly a billion people are hungry and around 1.5 billion people are obese. And as you just pointed out, often malnourished people are also obese. And that's, you know, really a result of a food system that focuses on starchy staple crops, you know, whether it's cassava, wheat, rice, or other crops. It focuses very little on nutrient-dense crops, you know, the fruits and vegetables and nutritious grains that actually provide the nutrients and the vitamins and the micronutrients that people need to live healthy, developed lives. You know, there are around 2 billion people around the world who suffer from micronutrient deficiencies. And again, this is a result of this over-reliance and over-investment in these starchy staples. And we really need to reassess what a healthy food system and what a healthy diet looks like. And so Food Tank is beginning work on focusing on nutrient density and how we can encourage policymakers and governments and the business community to really focus on producing more nutrient-dense crops so that we're providing, you know, not just calories and increasing yields, but that we're actually providing nourishment to folks. And so that's, you know, I think something that's, you know, again, at a tipping point, we really need to focus on these more nutritious crops if we're concerned about alleviating hunger and obesity worldwide.
Right. And another point that I just want to point out to those listening, you know, the interconnectedness. I mean, if we want to raise nutrient-dense crops, you know, all broccolis aren't created equal, as I know you know. You know, if our soil is depleted and the soil doesn't have the nutrients, the fruits and vegetables coming out of that soil is not going to be as nutrient-dense as it could be. So building up the soil, again, is so important in order to really raise healthy fruits and vegetables.
Absolutely. And again, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, if you're cooking foods improperly, they lose their nutrient density. So you can raise something that's very full of vitamins and nutrients, but if you're not cooking it properly, it loses all those important ingredients. So, you know, again, it has to be part of a holistic system where you're teaching and educating and raising awareness about the whole food system from, you know, the soil to what's on your plate and really knowing how to cook and grow things in a more sustainable way.
Mm-hmm. And does Food Tank address, you know, the issue of food insecurity and, you know, you're working on hunger somewhat. So how does that all play into the socioeconomics and trying to help people have access to healthier food?
Yeah, I mean, we try to really highlight the issues of access and affordability. You know, it's not just about growing more food or growing more nutrient-dense food. If people can't afford it and if they can't have access to it, if there's not a grocery store or farmer's market in their neighborhood, and, you know, then it's all for naught. So really, we, you know, what we've tried to do is highlight the importance of improving access and affordability and making sure that people can, you know, get the proper nutrition that they need to live healthier lives. It's, you know, something that we've highlighted in op-eds, we've highlighted in our website, we've done interviews really highlighting how important that is. But again, the United States has a long way to go on access and affordability. It's really a class issue, and we're not a country that's good at talking about class because we don't believe that there's, you know, a problem. And I think, you know, creating that awareness and showing that, you know, what you just described, we're not all created equal when it comes to food availability in this country, and that really needs to change.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So share with us before we run out of time, what Food Tank is really, I know you said right now you're focusing on the International Family Farming Year, but where do you see Food Tank going in the next, you know, next couple of years.
Yeah, we have a couple of exciting projects in the pipeline, one around true cost accounting, which will include a lot of the you know, the points that were made in the discussion with you today about the true costs of food we're producing. And if, you know, food right now at grocery stores is typically very inexpensive, but that's because we're not accounting for all the ingredients, if you will, that went into it. So figuring out what the metrics of food production really look like. And then this idea of democratizing innovation, which is really what Food Tank is all about. How do you get this information out to the people who need it the most? And how does innovation spread? How are different practices replicated or scaled up when they're needed where they're needed? And so I'm really excited about working on those projects over the next year. As I said, we'll be having our first Food Tank Summit in January in Washington, D.C.
It's in January?
Yeah, we'll be announcing that soon on our website and providing more details. I think it's going to be a really exciting two-day event, again, with a lot of focus on youth and hearing their voices. So, you know, a lot of other things in the pipeline. I would encourage your listeners to go to foodtank.com to get our weekly updates and to get more information and hopefully, you know, share their suggestions and the innovations that are working in their own communities with us.
And become a member.
Well, you know, if they can, that would be great.
Yes. Become a member and support the work you're doing because it's really incredible. And it is amazing the network that you've built up in just this 1 year. It's really a testament to the work that you're doing and how important it is. So
thank you.
Thank you
so
again.
Much. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're so welcome. And thank you for joining us today. It's been really great. Everyone
Thanks
out
again.
There listening, you've been listening to Danielle Nuremberg from Food Tank. Go onto their website at foodtank.org and find out some more information about what they're doing. And I'm Bhavani from IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here every Thursday at 10. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Bye for now.